Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here. Just so the audience knows, because of those bright lights, it's difficult for the speakers to really see very much out there. So I'm going to make believe there's no one in the audience right now. So this is the outline of my talk. I'm going to do a very brief precede to the molecular neurobiology of autism. That essentially will be one slide. A brief history of infant sibling research, just because this is an educational symposium and I'll give you some background. And then I'm going to dive right into the substance of my talk, which is a research program that Helen Tager-Flusberg and I have been doing for a number of years now. Do we have a pointer up here? No pointer?
You're supposed to use the mouse.
Okay. So, briefly, known genes account for probably a little bit less than 20% of the cases of autism. These include deletions on 22q, 16p, duplications, classic mental retardation symptoms, and the like. Any one of these usually accounts for less than 1% of the variants. The general impression is that this is highly heterogeneous. Each known gene usually accounts for less than 1%. The majority of the genes are unknown. Inherited factors are largely unaccounted for. And most mutations are partial loss of function. At a recent 16P meeting at the Simons Foundation, any number of genes have now been located on that region of chromosome 16 that links to 16P, but whether they play a causal role, we don't really know. But what we do know is that despite the challenge of finding genes involved in the causal pathways of autism, heritability estimates are still high, and we heard this last night from our speaker, Dr. Falstein. So it may be, therefore, the case that the study of enriched families might yield clues to early identification. So the goal of these high-risk infant studies is essentially to distinguish infants at high risk versus low risk for developing an autism spectrum disorder. Think of this as the intermediate or the end of phenotype. Then to predict infants who will go on to develop an autism spectrum disorder. And then when your frontal lobe is completely disconnected from the rest of your brain, to predict the severity of the disorder. So there are sort of two approaches people have taken to high-risk studies. One is infants with an older sibling diagnosed with an ASD. Recent figures put this prevalence at roughly 1 in 5. And this can be identified during the prenatal period. And then, of course, infants identified based on early screening, like the MCHAT and the like. And usually this applies to older infants, usually those older than a year or so of age. And then the comparison samples in these studies typically are low-risk controls, that is, with no family history, or infants with a sibling with another developmental disorder. And the question is, why are these populations interesting to study? So we know there's strong evidence for the efficacy of early behavioral interventions. There's a significant reduction in severity, leading in some cases, to more optimal outcomes. But the early identification of autism is essential to intervene early, ideally to intervene before the onset of the full-blown syndrome. And that, in turn, should bring about opportunities for preventative interventions, leading to a reduction in the number of diagnosed children. But of course, before you have to know on whom to intervene, and therefore that means how do you identify them early enough. So what do we know from current research on infants at risk? And a lot of this comes from the Baby SIBS Consortium. There's more than 18 groups. At last count, I think it's at least 20 from the US, Canada, Israel, and the UK. And the most important finding from this work has been heterogeneity in the early signs and behavioral domains, in the age of onset, in the developmental progression. And most or all of the risk signs that have little to no specificity or sensitivity on their own, only in clusters, which sort of mirrors the pattern found in diagnosed individuals and in general genetic models. So from this work, if you look at infants yet less than 6 months, basically at 6 months, there's really no signs that consistently will predict a later diagnosis. There might be rare infants with unusual behaviors like motor mannerisms or the absence of social affect or vocalization. Strikingly, most of the infants later diagnosed with autism look socially engaged at this age, indistinguishable from controls. As you move older, though, as you move older than a year, it gets a little bit more interesting. Work by Lonnie Swagenbaum and Susan Bryson and many others, say, for using the AOC, you see differences in eye contact or visual tracking, visual disengagement, orienting to name, imitation, social smile, reactivity, social interest, and sensory motor behaviors. These are the things that pop up in between 12 and 14 months. Negative temperament and affect might be another. Sometimes delays in language and gestural communication development, and sometimes a decrease in IQ between 12 and 36 months. So with that behind us, Let me turn my attention to a project that Helen and I launched 4 or 5 years ago. We know that there's a critical time period, at least in brain development, and of course empirically, between the first 12 months of life, where we actually know relatively little about development. The assumption in our case is that the behavioral repertoire of the infant is fairly limited, so if we focus instead on the neural substrate that underlies behavior, we might have more luck in early identification. So in this talk, I'm going to focus primarily on our electrophysiological and metabolic outcome measures of atypical neural development. And in our project, we compare infants at high risk by virtue of having at least one older sibling on the spectrum to those at low risk, no family history. And we do have a third group of infants with a family history or an older sibling with a language impairment, but that's been slow to recruit, and I won't be talking about those data today. So for the project overview, it's a very ambitious study. We start basically testing kids at 3 months. We see them at 6, 9, 12, 18, 24, and 36 months. At several of these test points, we actually see them on several occasions. They exit the study at 36 months, which is when we feel we can make a definitive diagnosis of the disorder. We have the classic behavioral measures. We have growth measures. We have various eye tracking measures as well. In deference to Dr. Grandin last night, I am obsessed with faces. I've been studying face perception for 20 years, so we do a lot on face perception. I hope she'll forgive me for that. Those of you who saw her talk last night, although if you didn't, what I just said made no sense. A lot on electrophysiology, focusing again on face processing and language processing, the same for metabolism. And then we have home and video diaries between 6 and 18 months. And I'm only going to talk about the electrophysiology and metabolism data today. So this is really going to be about endophenotypes. Do we see markers in these high-risk infants that distinguish them from the low-risk infants? And I'll start with neural synchrony, and this is work that was being done by Adrian Turney, a former graduate student in the lab. So the logic here is, in comparison to infants at low risk for autism, do infants at high risk have lower levels of gamma activity in the first year of life, which may reflect less neuronal integration, particularly in the frontal areas of the brain? And briefly, the answer to that is yes. Now, I'm very biased towards longitudinal studies, and as you see here, we're plotting data from 6 to 24 months. The red line represents the high-risk children, and the blue line represents the low-risk children. Red high, blue low. And as you can see here at the very beginning, there's much more gamma activity over frontal cortex in the low-risk children compared to the high-risk children. As they move towards 24 months, that changes. But it's not just the absolute difference at any slice in time as much as the developmental curve, which are quite different between the two groups. So in sum, then, at 6 months, we see a 35% reduction in gamma for the high versus low-risk group. By 24 months, these groups are now identical. But in the intervening period, the high-risk infants showed a remarkably flatter trajectory of change than the low-risk infants did. And this is a theme we might want to talk about later, which is the importance of looking at developmental curves rather than just a slice in time. Let me now turn to functional connectivity in a speech discrimination task. So now the question is, do infants at risk for autism show evidence of atypical functional connectivity during language processing? And do differences in functional connectivity between infants at high and low risk emerge in the first year of life? So the way this task works is that we use a double oddball paradigm, and we present a standard sound da, a native sound ta, and a non-native Hindu sound similar to da, which Helen has been trying to teach me to say for several years, and I still can't say this Hindu sound, probably because I can't hear it. And so during this task, we're recording straight through EEG, and I'm not going to talk about the ERP data. I'm going to talk about the EEG data. We examine the functional connectivity during this task by computing event-related linear coherence, which essentially estimates functional connectivity between brain regions. And so let's start with this slide here. We're now looking at the gamma band, which in our case is 30 to 50 hertz, and we're going to look at the connectivity in the left and the right hemispheres between posterior and anterior cortex, as you can see here. So the left panel is the left hemisphere, the right is the right, on the right side is the right hemisphere. And what you're seeing here is the following. For the high-risk children from 6 to 12 months, there's really no change at all in coherence between anterior and posterior sites in the left hemisphere, whereas there is the beginning of an increase from 6 to 12 months in the low-risk kids. If you move over to the right hemisphere, now what you see is for the low-risk children in blue, a dramatic increase in connectivity between posterior and anterior sites in the right hemisphere, and the absolute reverse pattern in the high-risk kids. And so showing you this slightly differently, for the high-risk children, blue is the left hemisphere now, and red is the right hemisphere. No change in coherence in the left between posterior and anterior, and a decline in coherence in the right. Whereas in the low-risk children, you basically see increased coherence between posterior and anterior sites in both hemispheres. So there are no significant differences in connectivity between the left, between the low and the high-risk children at 6 months. At 12 months, the low-risk infant shows significant higher connectivity in the right hemisphere compared to the high-risk kids. And at 12 months, the low-risk children show significant lateralization, while there's really no significant hemispheric lateralization in the high-risk group. Now, let's turn this on its head and look at the same issue during a face processing task. So here what we're doing is we're presenting infants with alternating images of their mother's face and a stranger's face. And the question is, do infants at high risk for autism show a neurotypical pattern of hemispheric specialization for face processing during the first year of life? Many of you know that there's going to be a specialization typically in the right posterior cortex for face processing, and the question is, when does that emerge, and do we see that in both groups? So we present them with familiar and unfamiliar faces, and I'm going to show you data on 6, 9, and 12-month-olds. And what you see here is the following. If you look at the so left hemisphere here and right hemisphere here. So as you move up the y-axis, you're shifting from left to right hemisphere. If you look at the low-risk children, again, this is the gamma band, you see from 6 to 12 months, this is the blue line, a gradual shift, a rather dramatic shift, to the right hemisphere. If you look at the high-risk children, you see the reverse. It's a shift to the left hemisphere. So it's atypical lateralization. Before I show you that, so similar to what we showed you in language, the theme here is an atypical pattern of lateralization or specialization in the high versus the low-risk kids. Now, these data will be presented in great length by Brandon Keene tomorrow at his talk, but I wanted to just briefly touch on them now. So this is a lateralization index at 12 months. And if you look way over here at the right, these are the low-risk children. There are 16 here. And you can see, again, the y-axis, this goes from left to right hemisphere. So you can see there's clearly a right hemisphere bias in the low-risk children. If you look at the high-risk children, none of whom, though, have a positive outcome, that is, they do not have autism, you still see a left hemisphere bias. If you look at the high-risk children who have autism, you can see an even more dramatic left hemisphere bias. And what this shows you here, this black line here, is the one low-risk children in our sample who has autism. So statistically, remember, 1 in 100, right? So we're about 100 children in the low-risk sample, and one has autism, and they look just like the high-risk group who had autism. And Brandon, again, will talk more about this tomorrow. So low-risk infants show a trajectory of increasing rightward lateralization, of intrahemispheric coherence, of face processing across the first year of life, the expected pattern. In contrast, the high-risk infants show an atypical pattern of increasing leftward lateralization. And in conjunction with the event-related coherence data I presented a few minutes ago, these results suggest that infants at risk for autism do not show a neurotypical pattern of domain-specific hemispheric specialization. So let me turn now, are we okay for time? To our metabolic data. Now, the question is there evidence of differences in neurometabolism in high versus lower risk infants? And the way we've gone about doing this is using near-infrared spectroscopy. And this work is being led by Sharon Fox, Jen Wagner, and Rhiannon Leister, all of whom are here. So what you're looking at here is our Hitachi 4000 system. These are silicon fingers, which essentially one emits light of different frequencies, two different frequencies, that penetrates the skull, refracts off the cortical surface, and is then picked up by an adjacent optode. You can see one of the ways we put this on the head. We have different systems for doing this now. And so the question is, what is NIRS? And so basically here you have light emission and light detection, and you can look at both oxy and deoxyhemoglobin. It's a similar concept as pulse oximetry, and also, I guess, fMRI, except that here we have measures of both oxy and deoxyhemoglobin, not just deoxyhemoglobin. So in this first paradigm, what we did is we showed infants short video clips of their mother or a stranger smiling or looking neutral. So we have the juxtaposition of a familiar face and an unfamiliar face, and a happy emotion versus a neutral emotion. And here are the findings, and I'll try to walk this through you slowly. So for those of you who don't know, one of the virtues of NIRS is it has very good spatial resolution so long as your area of interest is right on the cortical surface. And in fact, the real question is, how deep a sulci can you have for NIRS still to look? The advantage of babies is that the sulci are still fairly shallow, so we may be able to see activity both sitting on a gyrus and maybe sitting in a sulcus. The idea, though, is that what we're picking up sits beneath that optode. So let me walk you through this. So in the early system we had to pick where to put optodes. We didn't have full HUD coverage as we do now. So we focused on the frontal lobe and the right temporal and parietal lobe. And the reason is that in the emotion literature, we know the orbital frontal cortex plays an important role in processing some emotions, particularly happy. So when you see something in pink, it's representing a main effective face identity. That is, there's a difference between processing mother versus stranger. When you see something in green, this represents a difference between smiling and neutral. When you see something in yellow, that's a main effective group, high versus low risk. And when you see the dashed line, that's an interaction across these domains. So it may be a group by emotion or group by face interaction. So over the frontal cortex, you primarily see emotion and identity effects and some interaction effects, whereas over the temporal cortex, you see many more in the way of main effects of group, where the high and the low risk groups differed from one another. And this is all for oxyhemoglobin. You see a slightly different pattern for deoxyhemoglobin. Now you see very little in the way of main effects of group over the right temporal cortex, whereas you see a little bit more over the prefrontal cortex. So the high risk and the low risk groups demonstrate differential responses to face identity and emotion in the right posterior lateral and the orbital frontal cortex. The groups also differed in their oxy and deoxyhemoglobin responses, and this is something that I'm baffled by, why there's a difference in a group difference in oxy versus deoxy metabolism. So what are our future directions? And I'm going to add one to the end of these slides that dawned on me when I heard one of the questions before. So we have evidence of an endophenotype, but the question is, what does that really mean? We know that we have this neural signature that distinguishes the groups, and this is, but remember, only 1 in 5 of the high-risk groups will go on to develop the disorder. So we're finding this in the group as a whole. We want to know what that means mechanistically. So we know we have the endophenotype. The next phase of our work, as our children start to age into 36 months, is we'll be able to start to look more carefully at whether these measures actually predict or correlate with outcome. Some of this is not unlike structural data that shows differences that may be present in undiagnosed siblings of children with autism, and also functional differences. A beautiful paper Kevin Pelfrey published not too long ago in PNAS. So some of our goals are to examine growth trajectories on the assumption that growth curves may be more predictive than slices in time. And here we're spending a lot of time doing growth modeling. The use of aggregate measures is another. So can we combine we have genetics in the whole sample, can we combine our expression array data with, for example, our gamma activity, which may be more informative than individual tasks. And then can we create neurogenomic profiles of children by combining our DNA and our RNA data with imaging data, and so doing, start to make predictions about the individual course of children? And the last thing that we're doing comes to one of the first questions. So high heritability estimates for infant SIBs, we really don't know much about the genetics in this population. So we're studying many other populations where we do know about the genetics. So we see girls with Rett syndrome, kids with tuberous sclerosis, the copy number variant 16P, soon Fragile X, and I think soon as well a number of other genetic mutations. And the idea here is that if we know something about the genetic background, which we're kind of holding constant, that might give us some leverage on pathways to autism, which is really what this research agenda is all about. So by sampling broadly from these different populations, we hope to figure out, do we see markers that distinguish one group from another and those who will and will not develop the disorder? And the related issue is we shouldn't disregard the 4 out of 5 who will not develop autism. The question is, what happens to them? Dan Geschwin and I were speaking last week at the American Psychiatric Association, and we heard all kinds of fascinating speculation about the 4 out of 5. It was really very depressing what they were speculating. But the question for us is, what will our markers be able to predict something other than autism as well? So why don't I end there? Thank you for your time, and take some questions.
Any questions for Chuck Nelson?
A lot of parents of SIBs will do early intervention at the earliest time they can. Isn't that going to affect, you know, how those kids later develop?
Okay, so that's an interesting question. So let me tell you, address that indirectly first and then directly. We have an ethical issue in our study, which is when we start to see kids, often around 12 months, that are concerning, address this by the following. We can get kids seen by a developmental pediatrician within 2 weeks. So not only, I think, I'm hoping someone in my lab can remember the exact figure, but among the high-risk group, a not insignificant number are already getting early intervention, and we actually go out of our way to facilitate that. So by default, we have a confound. On the other hand, I see no other options. So that's something that, as our sample grows, we're going to have to factor into our analyses, because we can't do a natural history study and completely ignore the fact that a child is starting to show symptoms and not get them help.
I just wanted to comment on the developmental patterns. I think those are very interesting, and I was hoping you could comment on the theoretical implications of how to understand autism. For example, your trajectories, and you say the same thing, is they make clear that the snapshots really won't capture the difference, and to me that implies that any reducing the disease to some causal factor is difficult. And instead it points to some complexity, some interactions of factors that change itself in the course of development. So that maybe you can comment on that.
Okay, so that's a lot to take on. Let me give you an example and then try to slide into an answer to your question. We published a paper about a year ago, Bill Bazzo was the first author, using measures of multiscale entropy on EEG. And at 9 months of age, we found we could classify correctly the high and low risk groups to at least 80%, and we could classify the males to 100%. Sounded great. Didn't work at 6 or 12 months. And so it begs the question of, so why is that? It may well be the case that there are, why, for example, do girls have this disorder less than boys? It may be that in individual children, let's say there's a genetic vulnerability in the background, and I think we'd all agree to that, there may be early patterns of development that look atypical, but then there's some self-righting mechanism that brings them back to a normal trajectory, and the reverse, kids who look perfectly fine for, say, 12 months, and then start to change. It's only by doing this growth modeling that we're ever going to have sensitivity to that. But what that also argues is that brains develop in different ways. We know that from lots of work. And we need to be sensitive to these individual patterns of development. And that's going to take a lot of statistical work to be able to figure that out, because most of us don't pay attention to individuals. So I think what this is arguing is that we have to concede that even within the high-risk group, there'll be individual differences in the course of development. What we want to know is what might be little perturbations or protective factors that might occur at different developmental trajectories, or what genes are getting expressed late versus early that change circuitry. And that's something that, if I have another lifetime, I would probably spend a lot more of my time doing. I hope that answered your question.
More questions from anyone? I just am reminded of Ruth Feldman's talk about biosynchrony, and it's just moment by moment and getting early down. I guess you have to wait, 6 months, but I think there could really be something very, very important there.